We often take food for granted, especially in our country. We get hungry, we head for the fridge, we grab something, we eat. There are many, many more people and entities involved in that transaction, and today's guest thinks about them all. Raj Patel focuses much of his attention on the food system. He brings that focus to Southern Oregon University on Thursday evening at 8. We'll give you particulars as we go through. Raj Patel is a research professor in the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas. He studies the global food system and alternatives to it. He's currently working on a documentary project about the global food system with Steve James of Hoop Dreams and Prefontaine fame. Before his stint in Texas, Dr. Patel co-taught the 2014 Edible Education class at UC Berkeley with Michael Pollan, the author of The Omnivore's Dilemma. Dr. Patel is the author of several books of his own, including Stuffed and Starved. Raj Patel, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
It's good to be here, Jeffrey.
Now, I just read a few lines from an extensive resume. Let's get back to the beginning, and what started your interest in food?
I grew up in a convenience store, so I was surrounded by salt and fat and sugar, and I took it all very much for granted. But I really got interested in food because I was interested in globalization. And I was at the World Trade Organization protest in Seattle in 1999. And there were lots of people saying, well, you know, the World Trade Organization is a bad idea, which it was, which it continues to be. But what was really interesting was seeing a group of peasants, of farmers and farm workers and landless laborers who were marching in the street saying, hey, we've got a great idea about what to do about all this. And their vision for the future centered around food and a really positive vision for how it is that the world should be eating in the future. And I was really struck by the idea that while a lot of people were on the streets protesting against something, this movement of over 200 million farmers and farm workers and families had something really positive to contribute to the conversation. And that's how I got my interest piqued in food. And I've been following it ever since.
So were they talking about farmers' rights? Were they talking about the rights to good food, some combination thereof?
I think they're talking about everything. They had this idea of food sovereignty. Now, when people hear the word sovereignty, they either, you know, their eyes glaze over or they fall asleep or they get very angry. And the kind of sovereignty that these folks were talking about was the idea of basically having democracy in our food system. And that means democracy not only for the people who are growing, but also for the people who are eating. And democracy is the one thing that we really haven't had in our food system. You know, the way we eat today is really the outcome of a lot of colonialism and a lot of large corporations deciding what it is that goes into our mouths and into our into our shopping carts. But we've never really had a democratic conversation about, well, what should the planet grow? What should we grow and eat and process to make sure that everyone gets to eat well and eat fairly? And the beginnings of that democratic conversation was something that that La Via Campesina, this peasant movement, was showing and demonstrating.
It seems like those terms themselves can probably cause some argument, eat well and eat fairly. Do you find some conflict just over those terms?
Well, I mean, I think to eat well is already, you're right, a pretty sort of explosive thing to be saying, because on the one hand, of course, in some technical way, every American eats well. But also, we are among the most obese countries on Earth, and we now are eating so well and so much that our children, you know, one in three children born to white parents will develop type 2 diabetes, one in two children are born to parents of color. And now children born today are predicted to live shorter lives, to have a lower life expectancy than their parents because of the way that we eat today. So, yeah, eating well is a fairly loaded term. Eating fairly is even more loaded, of course, because the idea of fairness and justice when it comes to food is something that people have some resistance to. But on the other hand, you know, nobody likes hunger. Nobody likes to think that there are people in the world going hungry. It's one of our most primal charitable ideas of sharing bread and making sure that we feed the hungry to be able to end hunger in the world today. So I think although we may argue around what fairness means, I think no one listening today feels that anyone in the world deserves to go hungry.
What would you say is the number one issue facing the food supply?
frankly, I think it's poverty. I mean, if you look at the number of people who are going hungry today, we live in a world where there are nearly a billion people who are malnourished. And in the United States, we have 50 million people who are food insecure. Now, no one would say that you know, the U.S. is overpopulated or that there's not enough food in America. There's plenty of food here. And the problem is that the reason 50 million Americans are food insecure is because they are too poor to be able to afford their next meal. And so if we're serious about ending hunger in the United States, we should talk about poverty. If we're serious about ending hunger around the world, we should talk about poverty, too.
Are you heartened at all by some of the recent trends in the food business? Because as you were talking about, the fact is there is enough food. It's just not getting to all the people who need it. And I think about the places where people in poverty do tend to go. And we get the constant, you know, drumbeat of like, well, they buy junky food, or they go to McDonald's, or they go to whatever's close. And yet I was just reading yesterday about McDonald's trying to find its footing in the world again, because it is starting to get shunned by some people. And I also was hearing this morning about one of the major chicken manufacturers saying, we're not going to use antibiotics that are used on humans on our chickens anymore. And I wonder if you take some heart from these developments, think they're good steps in the right direction, or window dressing?
Well, I mean, you know, insofar as there are fewer antibiotics used in our meat and the pledges by some of the chicken manufacturers are serious, then that's it's like steering the Titanic just a little bit. I mean, if we think of the food system as a giant supertanker, then it will take a very long time to move these industrial giants into a path of genuine sustainability. But, you know, a little bit, a slightly reduced antibiotic use is, of course, welcome. But just to take note, Jeffrey, I mean, I think although we have this perception that only poor people go to McDonald's, in fact, when one looks at the use of fast food restaurants like McDonald's, it tends to be more a middle class phenomenon than a working class one. I think, you know, while it is nice that these organizations are trying to find their place in the world, the reason they're trying to find their place in the world is because of the protests by people who see that actually to lose the use of antibiotics in our medical system would be to throw away one of the most powerful tools that we have to be able to fight disease in humans. And the reason that antibiotic use is a problem is because the meat industry is using antibiotics to such an extent that they're now becoming less and less effective for human beings. That's something to watch out for.
Raj Patel is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more about food with him and take your phone calls and emails when we come back to the Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Raj Patel from the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas. He studies the global food system extensively and writes about it, talks about it, blogs about it, you name it. He has taken a look at just about everything in the food system. He'll be speaking this Thursday evening at 8 at the Southern Oregon University Music Recital Hall in Ashland, talking about Generation Food, Global Systemic, and Hopeful Ways to Feed the World. You can join us here now on the Jefferson Exchange as we continue our preview. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back. You were talking about growing up, Raj, in a convenience store. I assume that was a bit of hyperbole.
Not really. I mean, when you have two working parents in a convenience store that's open from 7 till 11, often after school you have to spend a lot of time in the stockroom.
Yes. The one of the questions I had for you there was I had read somewhere that you had written about people should stay out of supermarkets. That should be a big first step for just about everybody.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, if we're interested in eating locally and sustainably, then the minute you step into a supermarket, you've kind of given up a lot of your consumer power to a very, very powerful organization. So, people often forget that some of the most immense organizations in the world structuring the way that we eat today are supermarkets. And supermarkets are these machines to make us consume more than we'd like. I mean, you know, why is it, for instance, that the milk is always at the back at supermarkets? Well, it's there because the milk is the one item that we're usually in supermarkets to buy. And so the supermarkets are engineered to get us to walk as far as possible to the milk and as far as possible then to the checkout. And along the way, goods are positioned to make us give in to our impulses. And if you're thinking about shopping as a sort of rational experience, then the opposite of a rational experience is impulse. And impulse buying is what supermarkets are really there to profit from. So I think, you know, if you have to go into a supermarket, and we all do, going in with a list and going in well prepared and staying away from the center, as Michael Pollan suggests we do, that's a wise thing to do. But if we can figure out ways not to go into supermarkets at all, I think we'd be better off.
I noticed Michael Pollan's one of several people who write about sticking to the outside walls because that's where the fresh stuff is.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And whereas as you start drifting towards the center, the amount of things that are higher in salt and fat and sugar and the sort of epicenter of extremely or ultra processed foods is in those central aisles. And that's where, first of all, you know, our connection to the food system becomes most attenuated, but also where the stuff that's going to make us least healthy is going to be found.
All that great processed stuff. We were talking about food insecurity before, and I wanted to come back to some numbers here, because when we're talking about 1 billion people malnourished in the world out of 7 billion, that is a significant number. And I wonder if the issue of sustainability in food supply can be addressed without attention to population control. Is this part of what you talk about as well?
Yes. I mean, I think often when people think about population control, the issue around population sometimes can be fraught. And so it's important to be clear that in parts of the world where population is growing most, those parts of the world really aren't consuming vast amounts of food. We have enough food in the world today, and we have enough of a planet to support the kind of consumption that the average Tanzanian consumes in a year. But in the United States, we consume far more than our fair share. And so if you are interested really in sustainable population limitation, the thing to do would be to sterilize all Americans, because we have a much larger carbon footprint and a much larger food footprint than anyone else. But no one is suggesting that. I certainly don't want to be sterilized. But I would quite like the idea of populations being, and women being, in charge of their own bodies, to be able to choose the number of children they want, rather than it being a question of economic necessity or a decision that's forced on them by someone else. And so certainly talking about women's rights and talking about women and girls' education is something I'm very, very keen on talking about.
Well, I'm glad you brought... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, no, I think that's one of the sort of key issues if we're interested in a sustainable future. Those kinds of options and those kinds of results are certainly things that I'll be talking about later on this week. And in fact, one of the stories I'm sharing from Malawi, where we've been filming for the past few years, is a really inspiring example of where that's working out quite well.
Well, can you give us a hint about what that was?
I don't want to give everything away, but what's exciting about what we've seen in Malawi is a sort of scheme of women's empowerment that has really reduced the level of child malnutrition way below 50%, which is the average in Malawi. Mm-hmm. And the way that they've done it is something that's quite incredible. That really is about women's organizing and women's groups around food. It's the sort of thing you have to see to be able to believe. And so if you join us at the Southern Oregon University this week, you'll see a little bit more.
Okay. Well, to go further into the concept of education, though, because it is often talked about as a major tool in population control, it seems like it's also a major tool then in reforming the food system the way it exists right now. And then when I think about education and food, I start thinking about school cafeterias and how much has been made about the awful stuff that gets cranked out of there, or did for years. I mean, granted, many are trying to change now, but does that seem to you a major disconnect right there?
It does, and I think people forget we are educated every day into what to consume. I mean, when you have a world in which we move where our children are surrounded by advertising, advertising is a kind of education. It's not necessarily one that we have a whole lot of control over, but corporations are very keen on educating our kids on what to eat. It's not just about what they're presented with in the high school cafeteria, though that is a big political fight at the moment. A much bigger political fight, when you look globally, is the marketing of food to children. And what's been very interesting is when you're looking globally to see what countries outside outside the United States are doing to help push back and to help set kids on a sort of path of nutrition that doesn't consign them to type 2 diabetes. And what's really interesting is countries where, for example, that there are now taxes on soda and on junk food. More and more countries are adopting that kind of policy. India was the latest one, but there's a similar thing in Mexico. Brazil is moving even a step further by banning, or that they're considering banning, the marketing of everything to children, because what they're very keen on is for children to be educated in the classroom and not educated on the streets by billboards, or educated in front of the TV. In ways of eating that are going to be unhealthy. And so by banning the marketing of everything to children, they're actually respecting the idea that parents should take a more active role in teaching their children what to eat. And I would very much like to take full responsibility for my children's eating habits, for example. But it's hard when I'm up against billions of dollars of advertising from the fast food industry. It's not a fair fight. Me versus a $1 billion clown trying to persuade my kids to eat properly. And so, insofar as we're able to restrict advertising to children, I have a decent chance at having the freedom to parent my children. And it's very interesting that this kind of marketing and education argument actually is an argument about freedom and liberty. And that's something that many, many countries are starting to see the wisdom of. The United States still has a long way to go on in that regard. But I absolutely agree with you, Jeffrey, that education is an important way in which we move out of the quagmire we're in at the moment of bad food choices being reinforced by a bad food environment.
Interesting that you talk about it in the context of freedom and liberty, because it sounds like in parts of the world it's the freedom and liberty to be able to eat well. And I think the way that often gets construed in America is the freedom and liberty to eat however we choose, mm-hmm. which is not necessarily eating well. I mean, the fact is that I think a lot of responses you'll get to people who, let's go back to the $1 billion clown if we can beat on him a little more today. I mean, with all that salt and fat, hey, the stuff tastes good, and that's what I want to eat. It will be what a lot of people will tell you.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's very interesting how this compares to smoking, for example. I mean, for my sins, I used to smoke, and I had two kinds of attitude towards smoking. I very much, when I was a smoker, I very much wanted a cigarette, and I very much wanted not to want it. And I think many of us feel this kind of a conflicted relationship with the food system, whereas, our bodies are screaming for salt and fat and sugar, and we know that it's no good for us. And if we could come to some way of just minimizing that craving, those desires, I think many of us would be much happier. One of the ways to do that is to remove the temptation. It's not to say we should ban all salt, fat, and sugar, but by just removing the availability and the easy impulse and access to those things means that we stand a better chance of eating the kinds of diets we would choose for ourselves and our children. And in other words, it ends up being a choice about our choices, and we get to be much more mature and intelligent about what we choose, rather than being subject to impulse and saying, "Oh yeah, I ate that that Big Mac or whatever it is because I really really wanted it," as opposed to a more sort of reflective way of thinking about how it is we come to our meals.
Raj Patel is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a student of the world food system and how it works and how it doesn't work as well. He's also a professor, research professor at the University of Texas in Austin. And he'll be in Southern Oregon in a couple of days to talk at Southern Oregon University on Thursday evening at 8 at the Music Recital Hall on Generation Food, Global, Systemic, and Hopeful Ways to Feed the World. You can join us right now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760. And our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here is a call from Vajra in Sunny Valley. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Raj Patel.
Thank you. Good morning, gentlemen. I wanted to touch into what I feel and then ask Mr. Patel what he feels about this. What is the real baseline? What is the real root of this whole problem? And I think if we don't address that, we're just going to be working at symptoms. And that root, I believe you started touching into it when you talked about the women having control over their reproduction and this sort of thing, and what then the change that has made in the example that you gave. And it's basically patriarchy. And that patriarchy, the philosophy is we are separate from life. We are above animals. We're above the earth. We therefore commodify life And patriarchy is based on the, you know, switch over to male domination, and it ends up being a few males dominating all the males and all the females. That whole idea of we are of separation, and that the earth is a dead thing, and we can use whatever we want, and there's just an environment and it's resources. And unless we really get to the root, I think we're just, you know, fighting symptoms. And I'd like to know what you think about that, Mr. Patel.
All right. Thanks for the call, Vajra. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Vajra. I'm so excited that, I'm on a radio show where we can say the word patriarchy. I have to say that, this is it's exciting to be able to think about that word and those terms, because as a deep cause, it's often hidden. I don't think it's the cause. I don't think there's a single kind of unifying cause. I think that there's a number of different paths that have led us here, but I think patriarchy is absolutely central. And in fact, in the talk that I'll be giving, there's a painting that I use and draw on, and it's a painting by Thomas Gainsborough called Mr. and Mrs. Andrews, and it is a representation of the way that a man owns a woman in the 1750s in England, and patriarchy is a central theme, and it's definitely true that patriarchy is part of our partly to blame for the situation we're in at the moment. I also think, though, that the way, you know, just the idea of private property has a lot to explain, because I mean, patriarchy exists in a number of societies that haven't ended up in the awful quagmire of the modern food system that we have, and so patriarchy can't in and of itself explain everything. You need to be looking also at systems of private property. You need to look at systems of exploitation. One needs to think of a range of other factors, but I certainly think that patriarchy is an important part of explaining why it is that we're in the mess we're in today. And when one's thinking about, well, so what do we do about that? You know, you can say the word patriarchy till the cows come home, but you know, what difference does that make? Well, actually, it points us in the kinds of direction that where one can find hope. So when one looks at, for example, the fight for 15, you know, the current national movement in the United States for $15 an hour. And if you look at who's in the vanguard of that, it is invariably women who are not only working at McDonald's, but also in the care professions. And the recognition and the idea that care work should be valued and valued highly is an important way in which you can fight back very practically against this sort of cloudy idea of patriarchy. And so I certainly think that having the word patriarchy in mind helps you see and look for examples of hope that you wouldn't see otherwise.
Raj Patel, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about food. Raj, when you talk about food democracy, who are the people then, if we don't have it now then, who are the people who control the food system and don't do a good job, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, I think when you look at every major market for food commodities, so let's take wheat, for example, that there are four or five companies that control the global market in wheat, you know, Archer Daniels Midland and Bunge and Cargill and Dreyfus. Those corporations control a large slab of the global trade in wheat, and they do so without any democratic oversight to speak of. Those global markets exist and are being pushed for as we, you know, as we speak, in these trade arenas that are regulated very thinly by undemocratic courts like the ones at the World Trade Organization, and if this administration has its way, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So these trade agreements and the corporations that have asked our governments to author them seem to be much more powerful in regulating the flow of food around the world than ordinary citizens, and I think that's a source of concern. You know, when there is a sort of corporate oligarchy that's not only responsible for global trade but also for the marketing of food, for the processing of it, for the, you know, for its appearance in everywhere from penitentiaries to schools, when most of those decisions have been made without any consultation in a democratic way, that seems to me to be an example of an absent democracy and where corporations rather rule our lives because we let them. And what's interesting, particularly of late, is to see how many people are trying to push back against that with things like food policy councils and local purchasing ordinances and more and more city and state exercises in food policy that are democratic. And so right here in Austin in Texas, we're in the early stages of writing a food policy for the city in a very democratic way, we feel. And that's just one example of many where these kinds of, these sort of nascent democracies and democratic attempts to reclaim our food system are at work.
But I'm sure that the people who run the markets would come back to you saying, hey, look, it is democratic already. People vote with their wallets. And if they continue to buy it, we continue to make it.
And then the question would be, well, so how is it that, the majority of the chemicals that end up being applied to our food and in and around our environment are unregulated or are either there by by dint of the say-so of the corporations that promise and cross their hearts and hope to die that the foods that they give us are safe. I mean, it's true that the marketplace exists, but the marketplace was created often in a very undemocratic way. And the idea of democratic control of the markets also means, well, we need to make sure that, for example, the waste produced by things that are bought and sold in the market feature in the price of something that's bought and sold in the market. It's not very democratic for a burger to be sold for a dollar when its full environmental cost, when you add up the carbon that's released in its production or the greenhouse gas equivalents that are released in its production, when you think about the biodiversity loss, when you think about a range of other things, and the full cost of that burger should be nearer $200 rather than a dollar. It doesn't seem to be very democratic to have allowed that to go without some sort of public comment.
Raj Patel, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about food. We'll continue to do so and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Raj Patel, research professor in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's been researching and writing about the global food system for many years. We're getting him prior to a visit to Southern Oregon University in 2 days. He'll be speaking Thursday night at 8 at the Southern Oregon University Music Recital Hall on Generation Food, Global, Systemic, and Hopeful Ways to Feed the World. You can join our discussion right now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 throughout the listening area, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Here's another call from Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Raj Patel.
Good morning. I would like to suggest one way that individuals and their families can cut down on their own personal food intake, and that's cease watching television, or failing that, cease watching anything but public television. The commercials, the shows on TV are designed to get people to consume, and mostly to consume food. So if you refuse to watch that kind of thing and don't let your children watch it, then the more likely you are not to get overweight, and the more likely your children are to grow up eating more healthily, especially if you pay attention to what's going on around you. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate it. Thoughts, Raj?
Well, Mark, you've clearly been reading the trade press, because it's true that certainly the content of the marketing is often designed to make us consume more. But actually, just sitting in front of the television, even if you were watching a dead channel, is also associated with becoming more overweight. And children who watch just an hour of television are more likely to be obese. An hour of television a day. Are likely to be far more overweight than those who don't watch any or watch less than an hour. Even at surprisingly low doses, watching a television is a bad way of watching your waistline. I absolutely agree that just the content of things sold to us on television is designed to make us consume, and that's just a generic problem with television. But even just sitting in front of it is definitely not a good thing for children to do.
Yeah, and certainly is where I do most of my snacking on weekend nights. I try to leave it to just weekend nights. But, you know, in fact, you do get right into the very practice of how we eat. I know in Stuffed and Starved, you talk about savoring food. I mean, so you're talking about changing right down to the practices of eating.
Well, I think that's it. I mean, while, you know, who among us hasn't sat in front of the television occasionally with a large bowl of something we probably shouldn't be eating? But that's, you know, that's a once in a while kind of thing. Whereas, I mean, when you look at cultures that seem to have much better food practices, that are slimmer, that seem to enjoy food more, and whose cuisines we often try and copy very inadequately in some of our chain restaurants, the way that France, for example, or Italy, or other parts of the world, Japan, I mean, you know, this isn't just a European phenomenon, but other parts of the world where food is taken seriously involves sitting together and eating together. No, I mean, there's a, you know, you could accuse me then of just snobbery and just saying, well, you know, that's all very well, Raj, you and your fine dining sitting around a table eating together. But, you know, not only is in other parts of the world this is a sort of more generalized phenomenon, it's not just something that rich people get to do, but it's a fair criticism that actually in the United States, when people are running from one place to another in order to be able to hold down a job and be able to have insurance and being able to, you know, just pay the rent, it's hard to find time for everyone to eat together. It becomes a problem not just of culture, whatever that is, but a very practical problem of wages. I mean, if people aren't being paid enough, then everyone has to work much harder, and there's less time for things like eating and eating together. So one of the ways that this problem has been combated in Italy is by a group that's called Slow Food. I mean, Slow Food, everyone in the food world seems to have heard of, but Slow Food initially started off as an exercise in workers' rights, where they fought not only to have higher wages for agricultural workers, who are the poorest people in Italy, but also to have a two-hour lunch break so that people could both do all the things that we have to do at lunch, you know, run to the post office and do what have you, but then sit down and pay a fair price for the food that they were growing and enjoy it together. And, you know, unless we confront these problems of not having enough time and not having enough money, then You know, people can lecture you all you like about your food habits and where it is that you eat, but, you know, it becomes much harder for everyone to do that. And that's what's interesting, again, about things like the Fight for 15, you know, groups in the United States that are taking wages very seriously. You know, if we're serious about increasing wages and we push back on the number of hours we have to work in a concerted way, it seems to me that there will be more time to be able to enjoy food together, and that's going to be much better for everyone, not just for the enjoyment of food, but again, in terms of reducing obesity and type 2 diabetes and a range of other diet-related diseases.
We saw some figures recently that talk about the fact that to live in some cities, you'd have to work about 78 hours a week at minimum wage just to be able to afford an apartment. So given the context of what the money does to us, or the need for money does to us, that you can see how people spend a little less attention on the time they have for food.
Well, that's it, Jeffrey. And again, you know, and if you're running from one place to another and you're working those long hours, and I mean, that figure captures it perfectly. I mean, which of those 78 hours are you going to sit down and have a meal? I mean, the only chance you have to eat is off your lap in a drive-thru, and that's then inevitably you're exposing yourself to the kinds of food that are going to make you much more overweight.
You can join our discussion on food with Raj Patel at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Wolfgang used that very email address to write in. Good morning, Raj and Jeffrey. I really appreciate the show. Thank you. However, I think we're missing a causality here. Raj is referring to patriarchy as one factor and private property as another factor. Private property is one of the symptoms, if you will, of patriarchy. Pre-patriarchal societies and non-patriarchal societies, they still do exist, he says, have communal property. And does it make sense to, and it does make sense to do that. After all, is it my boat or your boat we're sinking? Communal property is prudent. Private control of life resources is destructive. How far do you go in terms of things like property ownership, land ownership, any of that stuff as we talk about in the context of food?
Well, Wolfgang has a great point. I mean, I think that at some level it makes sense to. I mean, if we're serious about, for example, consuming less as a country, then we need to be thinking about, well, what does that look like? And For me, it looks like less private property and more public property, more resources in common. And so I agree that actually, if we're serious about a sustainable food system, we do need to be thinking about things like land reform. Now, whenever if I say land reform, people run for the hills and think, oh, Robert Mugabe or the Soviet terror or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
I have no love for Robert Mugabe and for his regime. But what's interesting is if you were a landless farmer before his land reform and you have land now, the chances are you're better off. And what's interesting is that there have been a number of historical attempts to try and redress inequitable land holdings right here in the United States. And the aging of the farming population in America, the average age is now, 58? The average age of a farmer in America is 58, has prompted some people to start thinking more laterally about, well, so how do we get young people on the land when they really can't afford it? What does land reform in America look like? And one of the answers comes from New York State, where they're ready to forgive students their loans in exchange for students working on land that they that they may one day be able to own. And it seems to me that actually land reform and mechanisms for transferring land that involve the state coming in, buying land, and then distributing it to people who are willing to work it, that actually isn't a bad idea at all. A fair and just process of land reform to make sure that everyone who was born in America has a fair chance of being able to farm, to be able to work in a community, be able to have work that involves dignity. That's not a bad way to go.
But does then some political entity buy the land for distribution?
At the moment it's a very, very small scale program in New York State, where I think 10 people are eligible. But the idea is that the state would take the burden of forgiving those student loans for students who went to a state college, and assume the financial responsibility to engage in the transfer. And that doesn't, again, as I say, I mean, that's not a terribly bad role for governments to be having, to be engaged in state-led land reform. There's plenty of evidence to suggest that state-led land reform works. One of the examples of state-led land reform working is Japan. Another one is Taiwan, where after the end of the Second World War, the U.S. government reformed land holdings in those countries to make it a more equitable place and to allow the economy to grow. And although Japan's in the doldrums now, it did really rather well for a while, and so did Taiwan.
So beyond land reform, just the general ideas of the food system and how it is overseen, governed, however you choose to make the term. Is there any part of the world that's really getting it right? I mean, is there one country you can point to and say, hey, these guys are doing well for farmers, for nutrition, for hunger, right across the board?
There's no paradise on earth. There are lots of great examples. Brazil has some really interesting stuff around nutrition and around supporting farmers and supporting the connection between organic farming and schools, for example. 20% of food that is eaten in schools comes from local farmers, and there's a premium that schools can pay to be able to get organic and agroecologically grown food. But at the same time, Brazil is responsible for deforestation and huge soy industry that's selling all the soy to China. There are contradictions everywhere. But I think every country has its moments of hope, and I think that the idea of a food movement is to be able to join those dots together to make those kind of irresistible force.
And so let's talk about some of the things that are certainly concerns right now in the world. We haven't talked about GMOs. I can imagine those are part of your discussion at some point.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, just the concentration of power in the food system is equally reflected in the global seed industry. And I think part of the problem there is not just a problem of GMOs, but of monoculture. If we're serious about fighting climate change and having an agriculture that's ready to feed the world, we need to move away from one of the original sins of agriculture, which is monoculture, just growing one crop in a field, and thinking about diversifying the way we farm to becoming a sort of rich polyculture that's ready for climate change.
And then in passing, you mentioned the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, and I'm going to guess that since you're involved in the World Trade Organization protests in Seattle in 99, you probably have a dim view of the TPP.
Well, I do. I interned at the World Trade Organization to find out how it all worked, because I didn't want to base my opposition on just what people were telling me. I went inside and had a look, and I don't think that the economic arguments that are being made around the TPP hold any water. It seems to me that it's being sold both on a sort of general Sinophobia, you know, well, China is doing horrible things in the Pacific, we're not sure what they are, but they're clearly, we need to be doing our own horrible things before they do. That's a dumb argument. And so is the promise of jobs coming to the United States when, you know, we're already seeing downward wage pressure on the lowest, on the lowest paid jobs here. It doesn't seem to me that yet more exporting of jobs overseas is going to solve that problem.
So back to food in general. I mean, you must be heartened by some developments like the Eat Local movement, which has been going strong for a couple of years now. We have the farm to table efforts, farm to school, similar efforts to get particularly young people introduced to the idea that, hey, food actually comes from right nearby.
I am heartened by those, but I do think that they are steps along a road. I mean, there are ways in which eating locally can sometimes omit some important actors. For example, you know, we're eating locally, but we forget that maybe a lot of the local food is grown using migrant labor that isn't here anymore. And valuing that migrant labor is tremendously important, particularly a responsibility in the United States. But also thinking about the responsibilities that the United States has to pay the debts that were incurred in the food system that we've created. So, you know, the term Banana Republic, for instance, it points to the years when U.S. foreign policy aided the United Fruit Company in setting up republics in the Caribbean that were basically undemocratic and were there to be able to supply cheap fruit for the Americas. That involved, in some cases, horrible war crimes, the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. And those debts are debts that we in the United States need to repay. And so although there's something very important about eating locally, we do need to still think globally and historically about what it is that we owe the world for the way that we've behaved in the past.
You wrote an article for The Atlantic about 3 years ago called Abolish the Food Industry. Are you serious about going to that extent?
Well, I certainly think that we need to have big imaginations when it comes to big problems. And many of the problems in the food system today can be traced in a similar way that some people say, well, what we need to do is abolish the tobacco industry because, you know, I mean, if people want to grow and cure their own tobacco, that's fine. But having a business that sells these things that's guaranteed to cause harm is not a great idea. Similarly, I think we need to have that imagination to be able to know what it is we want. I mean, otherwise we're just left for choosing organic or inorganic, and that's not much of a choice at all.
Raj Patel will speak on Thursday night at 8 at the Southern Oregon University Music Recital Hall on Generation Food, Global, Systemic, and Hopeful Ways to Feed the World. He's a research professor at the University of Texas, Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
All right, take care. Great to have you.